If you have Exxon and gas companies contributing so much money to our politicians, it's going to be impossible to fix things like climate change. If people down on Wall Street are able to continue to give so much money to these campaigns, we're going to continue to give our tax dollars to the people who just don't even need those dollars, right? We could put them back into so many better things. So it matters where it comes from.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Mike Mineta is the national director of Wolfpack, a political action committee which was founded by Cenk of the Young Turks, which is seeking a constitutional convention for a 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution to ensure the integrity of our elections. They're focused on the question of money in politics. Mike has a great story of how he moved from splicing wires high up on telecommunications poles to volunteer activist and now director of Wolfpack. When you talk to Mike, you learn about how a state-driven constitutional convention might come to be, how it can be limited in scope and topic, and why he is driven to try to make it happen. So after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Mike Mineta and Wolfpack.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from Timeplots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. Timeplot's library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty good. Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Mike Mineta. I am the national director of Wolfpack. I currently live in Burlington, Vermont, although these days more on a plane than I am anywhere in particular. A lot of traveling with this work.
I'm a big fan of Vermont. I've spent a lot of time on the other side of the state in Bradford.
I actually grew up in New Hampshire, so not too far away.
Yeah. You grew up in New Hampshire? Yep. What sort of high school? What sort of college? What was the background?
Small town, New Hampshire, Claremont. Yeah. New Hampshire, it's kind of by Dartmouth, about 30 minutes south.
Yep.
Went to Stevens High School, played soccer, you know, did not think about politics much, just went to fish concerts.
Fish with a P.
Yes. P-H, yes. Plenty of fishing too. We had a family place in Lake Winnipesaukee, so did plenty of fishing and boating over there with the family. Went to college in New Haven, Connecticut, not Yale, but
what
UNH.
What else is in there? Yeah.
University of New Haven, played soccer there, and then went out to Fort Lewis College in Durango, Colorado, and spent actually most of my 20s in that town.
What gorgeous. Were you, so you, was that grad school there? Or you finishing up college there?
Yep. Didn't even finish, actually.
Really?
Stopped after a couple of years and just did the ski bum thing for a little bit at the Mountain Purgatory.
What were you studying as a major?
Business management.
So, that's a reason why you probably had to get out of there.
Yeah. I was just, it felt like I was just pouring money out for no particular reason. So,
I believe in learning by doing in the business space.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. So, but also being a ski bum in that part of the world is a great experience, right?
Oh, it was phenomenal. One of the best experiences I've had, actually. It was great.
How long did you stay doing that?
At the ski resort, I only did for 2 winters, but I was in that area for give or take maybe 8 or 9 years. I went back and forth from there in the East Coast a little bit.
I'm trying to picture the route from not finishing college in business and skiing a lot to starting a political action committee worried about money and politics. Can you sketch that out?
I didn't. That's the first thing. I didn't start it.
You did not start it?
No. My experience with Wolfpack has been pretty organic. I just started as a volunteer and listened to TYT, the Young Turks, for years, just their podcast initially. I used to have Sirius Radio and Air America. So Cenk founded Wolfpack, actually, the host of the Young Turks.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I started helping as much as I can because I just believed in it. You know, when he put out the plan, it was 2011 initially, he announced it. I was still working. I was working 40, 50 hours a week and then volunteering for Wolfpack for another 40
hours. Where were you working?
At the time of the phone company in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. So, it's been quite a journey. And then the years that I've had at Wolfpack have been really amazing in a lot of ways, stressful in a lot of ways. Pretty incredible experience.
So tell me about Jenk.
You know, his path is interesting too. He started the show in his living room because he was tired of the mainstream media just not giving us truth or anything close to the truth. And I think he had the show for 10 years maybe before he started Wolfpack. And look, it's just independent media. They're progressive leaning, but I heard him talk plenty of smack about Obama, you know, in those years when he wasn't doing the right thing, you know. So
well to the left of Obama.
Yes. Yes. I think that's fair. Yes. That was his journey, you know, and it was, I think it was a really hard one for him. It was not easy. You know, a lot of people did not believe in the show for many, many years, and it was a battle. And now they're the largest online news show in the world, you know, with over, I think over like 200 or 300 million views a month.
Is that true?
It is true. Yeah. Wow. The Wall Street Journal has actually credited them with being the largest online news show in the world. It is actually backed up with data.
That is pretty amazing accomplishment. Who was the team there? Who else is on that team?
Oh, it's a large team now. Yeah. Anna Kasparian is his co-host. Mm-hmm. Steve-O. He's got some friends from home back in the day that helped run it with him. Dave Kohler, John Iderola is another one of the hosts. Mm-hmm. J.R. Jackson.
How much is he involved in Wolfpack?
I mean, he's a pretty busy guy, so he can only do so much. You know, he'll do segments when we ask him, you know, if we've got legislation coming up. He actually just came to a committee hearing with us in Washington State. We brought about 250 people or so to a committee hearing, and you know, he went and testified, and that was a really cool experience. But I mean, he really cares. I mean, he's a volunteer. He doesn't get paid a dime for Wolfpack, and in fact, every time he does a membership drive or he asks his audience to donate to Wolfpack, it's money that could have been going to the show, but he chose to give it to us because he actually cares about the cause so much.
And how much does that help?
A lot. A lot.
Is that basically where your fundraising comes from?
Yeah, from people paying $10 a month. That's almost
that are enlisted through that show.
Yes.
Mainly.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we've been able to branch out a little bit. It's essentially people that have heard him talk about it that are willing to chip in, you know, 10, 25 bucks a month. That's 99.9% of where our fundraising comes from. So it's truly grassroots. We don't have any big donors. We've been accused of taking money from Soros, of course, but not a dime. And
Soros gives out a lot more money than he actually gives out somehow.
Yeah. Right. Yes. He's kind of a boogeyman. Not to say that we'd be against taking donations. We wouldn't be beholden to anyone. You know, we make our own decisions, but we're definitely grassroots. We only have a very small staff nationally. That's why I travel so much. I would rather not. Actually, it's getting to be pretty exhausting.
And it's hard to leave Vermont too.
It
Although
is.
Although in the it's winter, maybe not quite as hard.
Well, that's the thing. No, I love the winter, actually. I love skiing. I love snowboarding. I had a ski pass this winter. A friend of mine actually got it for me, and I didn't use it once, not a day. So I left second week of December, and I came back just like a couple weeks ago. So
what is the founding story then, as you heard it? How did this all get going? And
why? Okay. Yeah, that's a good question. So essentially, the bottom line is that Jenk was really sick of telling his audience that there's all this corruption happening in DC, mm-hmm. and no way to fix it. So he spent 3 years researching, how do we actually solve this? And he went to conferences, he talked to, you know, all the groups out there working on the issue of money and politics, and he came to really two conclusions in that time. One was, we need an amendment to solve this problem. It's the only thing that can go above Congress and the Supreme Court and be the law of the land for generations and not have to keep coming back to it. And the only thing that can protect state level legislation, which there's a lot of good groups like Represent Us that work at the state level. We think an amendment is a nice complement to be able to protect what they're doing for the long run. You know, anything that's happening in regards to fixing our political system at the state level needs to be protected with an amendment. So that's our role.
When has Citizens United come down versus when this is started up?
It came down in 2010, and this was started in 2011.
But he was researching already before that.
Yep.
Because there's basically...
It's been a disaster for a long time. It's been a problem
even before that.
Yeah, right? Jenk often says Citizens United only shot a dead horse. Or an injured horse, I forget how he says
it. Very quotable.
So that's number one, right? Mm-hmm. Conclusion of it's got to be an amendment. The second part was that a lot of people don't realize the majority of amendments have included the states applying for a convention for specific purposes. So that goes all the way back to the Bill of Rights. Congress wasn't going to do it, you know, those amendments, and New York and Virginia called for a convention to propose them. And that might not seem like a lot, but that was 25% of the states back then. Right now, we only have 15 for our issue for calling for a convention to get money out of politics. And that continued throughout our history, right? The 17th Amendment is the best example that we use, a very parallel situation that we find ourselves in today. People looked at the way that the U.S. senators used to be appointed, actually, right, by the state legislatures as corruption. And in fact, it was overt corruption, right? Bags of cash being dropped off at the state legislatures.
And now that's considered corrupt.
That was, yeah, believe it or not.
Okay.
Yeah, the people did not like that.
I thought it just depended on the size of the bags, but yeah.
And the Senate back then was known as the Millionaires Club.
Right. I mean, it's kind of like the House of Lords.
Now they're, yeah. I think now they're both safely considered the Millionaires Club. But yeah. But it was very obvious that the Senate was the problem back then. So what the people did, which we can learn from, is that they used every possible tool of democracy that they had. They did petitions, they did protests, they did ballot referendums, they did resolutions asking Congress to propose an amendment for the direct election of senators. But it wasn't quite enough. They came in at the end, started applying for a convention for that one purpose of direct election of senators, and they got all the way to just one state shy of the two-thirds needed to force a convention on that issue. Mm-hmm. And Congress said, oh yeah, of course we're in favor of that, and they proposed it themselves.
Why do you think they did that?
Because they don't want to give up their power. And I think that this is, what we're doing is we're calling for a convention to go around them to be able to propose an amendment at the state level. It's a threat to their power. We really want a convention. We think it's a very healthy thing. We think it was meant to be used.
People are typically scared of a convention because they think that it will be hijacked and right. and every issue under the sun, balanced budget amendments and pro-life amendments and you name it, will be debated. So that's why you're trying to make it very narrow.
Well, there's a lot of misinformation around that, unfortunately. And we can definitely get into that. And I think people will feel much better about it after hearing the information. Well, for one, as far as all these issues being considered, anything under the sun, Congress can do that right now on Capitol Hill. There's nothing stopping them from proposing a radical amendment, except the safeguard of ratification, right? 38 states have to approve anything that Congress proposes. 75% is a huge, huge number.
We never did get the equal rights for women.
It's very hard. Yeah. Exactly. We had hearings on it yesterday, right? It's extremely hard to get something into the Constitution. And that's why the founders, when they wrote Article 5, they set it up correctly because the same safeguard is there for a convention. So if we were to actually have a convention, states came together, it's only a place to have a conversation. And anything proposed, just like anything proposed from Congress, has to be approved by 75% of our states afterwards. So, one thing we say a lot is if you don't agree with something that 75% of the states agree on, then you're not afraid of a convention, you're afraid of democracy itself.
I'm something of a student of American politics and the way we're structured, but I have never thought about how a convention would take place, who would be able to participate, what votes they would have, how you would structure an amendment. How would that all happen?
Sure. Good question. And again, but that's assuming that we get to one. So if you think about it, if Congress got to the point where we had 30 states or 32 states, right, on any issue, let's say our issue, getting money to politics, they're going to have a decision to either call a convention and give that power to the states to come together and have a convention, or they're going to think, well, we can do this ourselves, which is what they've done historically. So it's
so you're unbelievably, more interested to push it,
yeah,
push it that way.
It's unbelievably more likely that they're going to do something with enough pressure. If 20, 25, 30 states was calling for a convention for this issue. But if we were to have a convention, there are multitude of resources out there. We know how conventions work is the bottom line. And this is something that Professor Lessig, Larry Lessig talks about a lot, is that we've had more conventions in America than congressional elections and presidential elections combined. We've had over 200 constitutional conventions at the state level. We still have 50 intact state constitutions. It's a process that is extremely familiar to Americans. So it's unlikely that Congress is going to take the time or the states are going to take the time to finalize what it would look like unless it was actually going to happen. Otherwise, it's a waste of resources. But if it's going to happen, we're more than capable of figuring it out.
So I guess I understand the strategy here. You put a lot of pressure on Congress to make an amendment on this subject because we got to get money out of politics. What are you putting forward as sort of like sample text for that? Or what are you trying to make happen?
Our resolution is, I think, one of the most logical bipartisan pieces of legislation because we don't dictate what the amendment has to say. We don't think, and this is backed up in the legal reports, which I'll get into in a minute too, that have been done around this process, that the way that it was written was designed to be determined ahead of time. The convention itself is supposed to be where the deliberation happens, right? So you call a convention for a purpose, and the states come together, they figure out exactly how it's worded, and then they have to craft it good enough to be approved by 75% of our states. So what our resolutions do is they call for a convention to address concerns raised by Citizens United in related cases. That's the wording in our resolution. And, you know, it goes on to explain that our founders intended this country to be dependent upon the people alone, and it's become dependent on special interests and wealthy elites. So it's explained. The issue is explained in our resolution, but we feel that we have to word it that way because we've got to bring both parties in. If we're actually going to solve this, we have to trust that the process is going to work, and we have to bring the other side in. So I think a lot of people I've seen in this movement will say the definition of bipartisanship is getting the other side to agree with me and my solution, right, and my exact wording. We would love to do it. I mean, believe me, we could write a really strong amendment, but then it's just a couple of us people, you know, in one group writing an amendment. You could probably do it. I mean, I don't think, it doesn't say you can't do it as far as like if we got 34 states to agree on exact wording, but there's no way. It's not politically possible to get 34 states, we don't believe, because they had no buy-in. They weren't part of that process that deliberated. So that's why. What we're doing is we're calling for the national conversation to fix our broken campaign finance system. And that's why we are able to get, we've had hundreds of Republicans vote, which is not, it's not typically seen as a conservative issue. And that's a challenge, right, in this movement. I don't think that that's a secret. But we have Republican sponsors. We have a multitude of Republican sponsors right now for our legislation. I'll just give you one example. A Republican senator in one of the states we passed mostly agreed with Citizens United, but yet championed our resolution because he said, you know, look, I think that corporations should be able to give money to my campaign and it shouldn't be limited, but I hate the idea of outside money that's not disclosed pouring into our state and even from out of the country sometimes. He's like, that has to be fixed. That's out of control. So for that reason, I support this conversation. And, you know, again, with the knowledge that any amendment would have to be approved by 75% of our states afterwards. There was another senator in Missouri. We actually passed the Missouri Senate twice with more Republicans than Democrats. And one of them stood up and said, hey, I might not ultimately agree with the exact amendment that comes out of a convention on this issue, but I see the need to address our, he called it campaign industrial complex, right? So people get it. This issue is what a convention is tailor-made for, in our opinion. This is the issue that reaches up to 96% of the population wanting something done about it, right? So let's provide a venue because Congress is not that venue. It's a little bit naive to think that Congress is going to do it. This problem has gotten worse for 40 or 50 years and we don't have time to wait on them. You know, all the issues that we care about are tied back to this one issue of money and politics.
Well, they have passed reforms in this area from time to time. They passed McCain-Feingold. They passed Federal Election Commission stuff in the 70s. Yep.
But none of it has stopped our elections from being more expensive every cycle, right?
So let's discuss that for a second. So I completely buy the idea that particular money in politics is bad, right? Like people who are getting advantages for their businesses or something like that. But in order for people running for office to communicate, they need to be able to spend money. Is it the amount of money or is it the kind of money? What are you really upset about?
And that's why the term get money out of politics.
Yeah.
I know we use it a lot because it's kind of a catchphrase and it's easy to use it, but it's not literally possible, right? So what we're talking about here is reforming our campaign finance system essentially so that our elected officials are more responsive and beholden to the people than they are to the special interest groups. So that's the bottom line. And what's the perfect system? I don't know, but like for example, if you have Exxon and gas companies contributing so much money to our politicians, it's going to be impossible to fix things like climate change. If people down on Wall Street are able to continue to give so much money to these campaigns, we're going to continue to give our tax dollars to the people who just don't even need those dollars, right? We could put them back into so many better things. So it matters where it comes from. And it used to be better, right? I mean, it wasn't always this out of control. It has gotten worse for about 40, 50 years, right? So what we're talking about really is getting back to a place of common sense campaign finance laws. There are people on the right who talk about tax credits. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with John Pudner and Take Back Our Republic.
No.
He was the one who ran the campaign for Dave Brat back in the day who unseated Eric Cantor. Mm-hmm. He started a group because he sees how bad this problem is of money influencing our elections. and he thinks that people should be awarded tax credits, and then you can give, you know, essentially kind of like a voucher, right, to which candidate you like.
And Senator Gillibrand just came out with that in the presidential campaign.
Yeah, so there are a multitude of systems that we could look at that would be better. And then look, another problem is just simply the amount of time that our politicians have to raise.
Yeah, it's terrible.
So, you know, up to 70% of their time, they have to go across the street into a phone booth and just dial for dollars all day. It's really horrific. And I've heard, it's always after they leave office, right? A congressman will go on 60 Minutes, you know, the week after they leave office and basically talk about how awful it was to raise money. So we have to fix that. People in Congress don't like it. So, you know, one example of a system that I've heard that makes sense to me is, and I might not get this exactly right, but the essence I think is correct, and that is like Connecticut's system of publicly funded elections, which is, one of the legislators told me they initially found the money like they called it like in the seat cushions, money that was just sitting there in an account for, they have to have money for people who return bottles, like 5-10 cents for a bottle, but no one ever did that. Over the years, there's this huge fund of just money sitting there. They used it to kick off the program. What you have to do is you have to go out and you still have to raise money. So you have to go into your community and you have to demonstrate a certain amount of support, right? So you have to get X number of petition signatures, depending on which level of office it is. You have to raise a certain amount of money, and every candidate has the same markers. So, and it's reasonable, right? So it's, you know, what, maybe it's 10,000 for a state level seat, something like that, or it might even be less. And then if you qualify, then you would get the larger amount of money to be able to get your message out there to the public. Because like you said, of course, there has to be money, or you have to be able to buy ads and inform the public of what your positions are. But everyone would have the same amount. And that's the most important thing, right? So then it would become about, you know, who's A, good at managing their money, which isn't a bad thing, I don't think, to have in someone who's going to be representing you. And who has the best message? You know, who's going to go out there and actually and talk to the people rather than just sitting in a booth asking someone for $2 million and then go turn around and run TV ads that are almost definitely skewed and full of shit, right? Let's be honest. Most of the ads are just whatever hype you can come up with, and you're going to blast it into people more than somebody who's not going to be able to raise that money from some rich company or a rich person that they happen to know. So much of this is about just where it's coming from. And if we can solve it, if we can solve that problem, we're going to be able to do, I think, a lot of just incredible things that we have the potential to do in this country, but just can't. We're stuck in so many ways.
We do seem very stuck. Tell me a little bit about your route from volunteer to your current role.
Yeah, so it just kind of worked out really well for me. When I was, at first volunteering for Wolfpack, I'd actually just been laid off from the phone company the same week that Cenk announced Wolfpack. It wasn't a surprise. There's like Verizon and Fairpoint did this deal where they hired hundreds of people for like a 3-year stint. So it wasn't a big surprise. I knew it was coming, but the timing was incredible. And I just was able to take, you know, a decent amount of time right at the very beginning and just start organizing people. Initially, it was a lot of social media stuff, organizing the different states, getting that going. But then I had to get another job in the phone company for another full year after that. But again, I just continued to do it because I just really love.
Are we talking up on the pole, or are we talking in the office?
Yeah, I had a bucket truck. I was up on the pole. I was a splicer. Yep. And so it was back and forth. You know, initially when when I first started, I had time, but that only lasted a couple months. And then I was working a full time job, also doing phone work, and that was a lot. That was working like, you know, between that job and Wolfpack 80 to 90 hours a week.
So, but at some point, you must have been spotted among the volunteers as someone with capacity to manage or to take on leadership. How did that happen?
Yeah, it was just organizing volunteers. Yeah. It was organizing conference calls, you know, which is something that we really emphasize at Wolfpack, and creating some resources for people to be able to understand what our plan is. Just kind of, took initiative and got a lot of that stuff done in the early days. And it was small. Wolfpack was, I think, at the very beginning, there was only 5 people on a national call. Now when we do one, you know, it could be anywhere between 200 and, you know, 500 people we've had on some calls. So
why is it called Wolfpack?
2 reasons. I think one, he just wanted it to sound aggressive because that's kind of Cenk's personality. You know, they're not coming for us anymore. We're coming for them. We're not going to be pushed around anymore. And just the fact that Wolfpacks work as a team. You can't do it alone. You know, you need a pack.
But not really tied exactly to campaign finance through the name.
No, definitely not. No.
So yeah, because when I first saw it, I was like, I wonder what this is.
Yeah. Yeah, some people love it, some people hate it, you know, as far as the name, but it is what it is.
Who do you find to be your best allies in this fight?
A couple groups. I would say I would point out like American Promise, They're great. Jeff Clements, Ben Gubitz over at American Promise. They're working for an amendment as well. That's their goal, the 20th Amendment.
28th.
Okay. They support all paths. They're concentrating mostly on Congress is where they put their energy. They just had a bill that they were pushing up in New Hampshire.
So are they like competition for you?
No, definitely not. I don't think there's any group in this movement that I would see as competition.
Okay.
I think it's all good. Anything that anyone's doing to advance the conversation, to advance legislation around campaign finance reform is good. And it goes back to precedent, right? The historical precedents that we have is the early 1900s when their groups weren't fighting each other. And everyone was united in getting that amendment, and it happened. So that's what we really have to do now.
And there was legislation around then to make corporate contributions illegal. I don't know quite specifically the history on it, but definitely not the amendment path, but through Congress.
Right. Yep. Oh, yeah. There's been all kinds of attempts. Yeah. And, you know, we just haven't quite gotten there yet.
Who else besides American Promise is in the
ally? I would say Represent Us is doing great work. They're concentrating on state level legislation. Josh Silver, Ben Cohen, Stamp Stampede. They do great work as well, getting the message out there. They stamp bills is the main thing that they do. And Take Back Our Republic, as I mentioned, John Pudner. I would say Issue One, Public Citizen. Yeah, there's a lot of good groups out there doing good things.
These are all pretty much bipartisan, nonpartisan.
Absolutely.
World.
Every one of those is that I mentioned.
Anyone in the partisan space, do you think, been helpful? There is a group, End Citizens United, which we had on the show earlier, and they'd raised a lot of money, maybe $30 million or more.
Oh, jeez. What we could do with $30 million. Wow.
I don't quote me on that figure, but yeah. But do you ever try to partner up with people like that?
We haven't. I mean, look, with regards to our path, as far as pushing for the convention to get this done, I think we're the only group in the country. It's really surprising to me since given the history of, you know, amending the Constitution. Once we prove that like we're needed in this space, whether we have a convention or whether we keep adding states to the board, I believe that there's going to be convention calls for every issue under the sun, right? Probably. Right now, it's for a couple issues, but no, right now we're pretty much... We're the lone wolf, ironically.
So I guess you're in sort of in the toiling in the vineyards phase of a social movement, right? I did look at the disclosure of your own fundraising. What I saw that was nice about it was that it was, you know, the last 4 or 5 years, year over year, bigger every year, and you're growing. But on the scale of what's out there, fairly small. How do you keep going when you're yet early in that march?
Well, that's really tough, actually. And it's stressful, and I'm trying to figure that out, honestly. We all are. The thing that keeps me going is that I know we're right. I know that we have a strong plan here. I know that it's a necessary part of this movement, and it's too urgent. You know, again, it comes back to there are too many things that are tied to this. You know, if you care about the environment from the left, they've given us a deadline of 11 years now until it's past the point of no return. I mean, in a lot of ways, we kind of are already there, right? So that definitely keeps me going. If you're conservative and you don't necessarily think that that's an issue, we're also not going to balance the budget or do anything close to fiscal responsibility if we're giving away billions of our dollars of our tax dollars to companies who don't even pay American taxes and who don't need it. Yeah, I think it's just a necessary thing. And again, the thing that gives me hope would also be numbers. Math, which is ironic because I hated math growing up. But if you think about it, there's over 300 million people in this country. And with regards to having resources to get this done, because we absolutely need more resources, you're right. But if even just 1/3 of 1% of our population was willing to chip in like $10 a month to our plan, that would be over $10 million a month, right?
How many people currently are chipping in the $10 that you...
About 2,200. So a little over 2,000 members right now paying anywhere, you know, between $10 and $100 a month. So yeah, anyone that's listening, we would massively appreciate it if you go to our website and become a member. It's a people powered movement.
So if Cenk, as you say, has the largest online news show in the world and that many people are paying attention and he's coming from that progressive standpoint that believes in this, why are so few people charged up about this enough to give you a measly $10?
Well, a couple of different reasons. One, he spread himself way too thin over there. He's taken on too many projects. So he also has a business, right? So he can't be fundraising for Wolfpack all the time. He did in the early days and throughout the last several years, he does it sporadically whenever he can on the show. But he started Justice Democrats, right? The group that recruited Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez last year. Mm-hmm. I told him he shouldn't do it. I said, you're crazy. You're going to kill yourself. You know, this is too much. Mm-hmm. But he went forward with it and he raised, you know, a ton of money for that group. Mm-hmm. And still does, you know, so he's doing a lot of other things mm-hmm. in, you know, over there at TYT, and he's got obligations to the business. So at one point we've had at least more than triple that many members, but you know, look, people that their cards expire, they, you know, they can't afford it over time. So it's like, you know, it's an uphill battle for us. We're constantly having to get out there and tell people about our plan and build our army.
So if you had 5 minutes on a national network of somewhat larger listenership than I have right here, what's your strongest pitch for Wolfpack and what you're trying to accomplish?
Sure. I would say, you know, just like I did in the beginning, it's not complicated, right? This is a systemic problem of money influencing our elections. An amendment is needed to solve this for the long run. There are only two ways to get an amendment. One is through Congress. We don't believe that's realistic. Two-thirds of them is not going to change the way that they got elected. That's a really almost borderline naive, you know, thought. The second way, the only other way, they didn't give us 10, our founders, unfortunately, right? They only gave us two. So the only other way to do it is to get the states to start applying for a convention for this one issue of resolving, you know, the massive amount of money in our politics. That's what we're doing at Wolfpack so far. We've gotten 5 states to do it. Vermont was the first. California was the second. Illinois, New Jersey, Rhode Island. And we've had many more states that we passed in just one chamber throughout the years. You know, we need more momentum. We need more help. We need more volunteers. We need more members. Thing to know about the convention process is that it has been studied extensively by legitimate organizations. So the Department of Justice, under both Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan, the Congressional Research Service has done 4 reports on the convention process. The American Bar Association, the Rotunda Constitutional Law textbook, Harvard Law Review. Every single one of those legitimate organizations has concluded that the states have the power to call a convention limited to a single subject and that there are multiple mechanisms in place for those limitations to be enforced.
When you're saying that with conviction and citing, you know, authority, but you must be saying that because somebody thinks the opposite.
Yeah, good point. Yes.
So yes. What's going
on
there on the other
side? Almost.
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand that.
So unfortunately for us, mm-hmm. what happened was we got those 5 states and the momentum was incredible. People were starting to believe maybe there's a way to do this, to go around Congress. The money was pouring in, the volunteers were pouring in. And then, well, again, I guess I'll just be honest about it. It was a group called Common Cause. They put out a report called The Dangerous Path. And they,
which would typically be a group aligned with
absolutely.
You.
Yeah. It's really unfortunate. You know, they do a lot of good work and even in this realm that, you know, of money and politics. So they've been against the convention for a long time. They were against one in the 80s for when there was a push for a balanced budget convention.
They think it's not limitable and it might open up a lot of barrels of worms.
Yep. So what happened was they put out the report and it scared a lot of people off. And that includes legislators, unfortunately. So a lot of times we find ourselves in a situation where we can get 20 out of 25, maybe like in Washington recently, 20 out of 5 senators to say, yeah, this makes total sense. Let's do it. And then there's one or two people in the wrong position that have gotten this like kind of unfounded fear bug and it stopped us. So it's, I mean, look, we have over 45,000 volunteers at Wolfpack and growing, but now I've seen this with my own eyes and it's kind of heartbreaking. You know, I've seen 80-year-old people. I've seen 13-year-old volunteers go to a state house, try to talk to a legislator about fixing Citizens United and have them run down the hallway from them and slam the door in their face because they're afraid, they think we're the enemy. So that's the damage that this has done. This opposition has done.
Because they think you're the enemy because of this open convention problem, not because of something else about wolves?
That's right.
Okay.
No, absolutely. No, it is. It's so they've done a pretty good job, to their credit, of, you know, using their network. They got like a pretty good number of organizations to sign on against a convention for any reason, right? So we need to go and educate people. And when we do, when we give them all the facts, almost everybody's on our side. The ones that we can't convince are usually people who already have a preconceived notion and they're just not going to be open to hearing our case. But everyone else is like, oh, this makes sense. And let me just, I'll elaborate on that actually. It's easy to say, unfortunately for us, it's very easy to say, you know, be afraid, boo. Be afraid of a convention. We're going to lose all of our rights. It's exhausting and takes a little bit more time to explain all the reasons why we should be doing this.
Have you thought of going to Common Cause and getting them to retract?
Yeah, I mean, we've reached out to them. We've had some debates with them. We debated them a year ago, janked it actually. You know, we're working on it. And I hope we can come to some sort of a working agreement in the future. I really do. I guess I'll just explain where it's coming from, right? So Robert Reich, he was the chairman of Common Cause for a while. He's not right now. But when he was, about a year ago, he put out a video saying, you know, convention was the greatest threat to American democracy. Not helpful for us, right?
And exactly, and typically a guy who would be a leader in super campaign finance reform.
Yes. So, but what he says in that video is the precedence that we have is the 1787 convention in Philadelphia, and the precedence is that they threw out the Articles of Confederation, and that's it. Like, that's what's going to happen at this convention, right? So that is where
we could lose our whole constitution. Right. We could lose our amendment structure. We could really go backwards instead of forward.
That's where the opposition
is. I'm scared
now. That's the heart of it. Yeah, great. However, it's really important to know, and Professor Lawrence Lessig, who's taught a class on Article 5, and also is a good friend of Robert Reich's, put out a 5-series podcast explaining why that's wrong.
I want to see the debate.
So you can just Google that, right? Yeah. You know, Larry Lessig, The Other Way is the podcast, TYT Network. But here's the bottom line. It's not that complicated. That's not what happened in 1787. He's just flat out wrong, right? So what he's implying is that they had a convention and they came out of that convention and said, boo, here's the new constitution, and forced it upon the country. Number one, Articles of Confederation was not a constitution. It was more of a treaty among separate nations that were free to pull out of it, right? So it's not, first of all, it's just not even a comparable document. But number two, and this is, I think, the easier one to digest.
Yeah.
Is that all they did in 1787 was, yes, they wrote a new constitution, but they proposed it to Congress.
Yeah.
So it was Congress that actually took that constitution and sent it out to the states and said, if 75% of our states approve it, then it's the new constitution. But they didn't force it on the country. But, you know, no state was required to become part of that new constitution. In fact, Rhode Island was an independent country for a short time. They wrote a letter to Congress asking for good foreign relations, so which is just more adorable than anything else. Right? But that's the heart. That is the opposition. And it's not true. It's not actually accurate history of what happened. But again, that was 240 years ago. They didn't even have electricity back then. Now, this convention called under an existing constitution, right? And they say, well, it's not clear on, you know, how a convention would work. True, but the constitution is not clear on basically anything, right? It's a guideline. So the important point is that it's crystal clear on the power of a convention. There's no court in this country, even the Supreme Court, as bad as they are on plenty of things, especially this issue, cannot interpret it any other way. It says in Article 5, 2/3 of Congress can propose an amendment that has to be ratified by 3/4 of the states, or 2/3 of the states can call for a convention to propose amendments that have to be approved by 2/3 of our state governments afterwards. So
there's a lot of bars there. So it seems fairly unlikely that something tragically horrible would come out of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, it's, again, these reports, it's 100% to zero that there are serious reports that have looked at this.
Yeah.
Like I mentioned, there's not one peer-reviewed report that it says the Roanoke Convention
is sort of like climate change.
It's actually a lot like that. Yeah, and honestly, it's even more. It's 100. It's not any 99. It's actually 100. And we keep asking them. I've asked Common Cause, send us a peer-reviewed report that goes against, you know, what we're saying here, and they can't do it. So, but here's another really important point to know with regards to this. So another thing that the opposition will say is we can't support Wolfpack's Article 5 call for, you know, fixing Citizens United because we're 6 states away from calling a convention. We're 6 states away from getting the scary convention, right? We have 28 states. Well, it's true that there are 28 states that are applying for a convention on a balanced budget amendment, but that's been true. They've been trying for over 50 years. A side note, they got up to 32 states calling for a balanced budget
backwards
in the 80s. Yeah. And what happened was, and this is in these reports, the Department of Justice and Congressional Research Service say that those convention pushes that they did back then led to fiscal responsibility coming out of Congress and ultimately a balanced budget in the 90s. They point to the convention push for a balanced budget as one of the reasons that Congress took action. More precedence, this is what we need to do for issues that they won't solve. So, but then, so just to finish that thought, since we balanced the budget in the 90s, the states rescinded them because there was no longer a need, which the states have every right to do. And they got all the way back down to 12 or 13. Now that the budget is out of control again, there's a movement there. But here's the most important point maybe that I'm going to make here. And that is that Congress officially started counting these applications for the first time in history 2 years ago. So it's a guy in Hawaii, Dan Marks. He wrote to the House clerk and he said, hey, what's the deal? It's your constitutional duty to count these applications. There have been over 400 of them, by the way, by 49 states. So it's something that the states do all the time. It's not like a big deal. Mm-hmm. The House clerk wrote back and said, you're right. which is kind of amazing.
That is amazing.
And so they...
Where do we find that?
So you can Google it. Article 5 convention calls U.S. House clerk. You'll be able to see them.
And how many are in the five states or greater of that?
That we got? Yeah, that we passed?
Well, you've got five states.
Yeah.
But how many of the other calls?
So this is the most important point. Yeah. So they put up a website, and they started counting them. Mm-hmm. The first one they ever counted in the history of the United States was the Wolfpack Resolution from Illinois for free and fair elections, which is just really cool history for us more than anything.
Definitely.
So for a short time, we were the only application ever counted by the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. But much more important to this conversation is that since then, they've counted 78 applications officially right now from 38 states. So we're already right now, according to Congress, four more than the constitutional requirement, but they're on all kinds of different issues.
Right. So it must be the case that you can have a specific call.
Of course.
Yeah. Otherwise, they would have had to rule that we're there.
Or they're in violation of the Constitution right now. Right. Yes. So if someone out there is bored and has a lot of money and wants to sue Congress, you know, because that would be also helpful, right? You could sue Congress right now and say, hey,
well, then we run into the common cause problem of, oh no, we're going to have an open convention.
Well, I think what would happen most likely is that if someone sued Congress to say...
They would say there's a specific...
Someone would say
it depends on what it's on.
Exactly. Yeah. Most likely. If someone sued to say you're at 38 states, the Constitution says 34, mm-hmm. You're in violation, you need to have a convention right now, most likely Congress would come back and say, no, we're counting them in separate piles based on subject matter. And we would say, yeah, thank you.
So when you're imagining success here and you're thinking, okay, we're moving down the road, sure, we had a hiccup with Common Cause, you know, we got five states and we're going to get 10 and then 15 and so on, what do you think is happening that's allowing this? What's changing in the political opportunity structure or whatever that's allowing you to crack this problem and actually change the country?
Yeah, well, I think the conversation has gotten louder as we've sort of gone forward here, right? So there are many things happening. Again, what we're doing at Wolfpack, I think, is vital. It has to be part of the conversation because, you know, this is our way to communicate with Congress. In fact, when we passed Vermont, Patrick Leahy was the chair of the Judiciary Committee at the time. The Senate Judiciary Committee held hearings on the Udall Amendment, which deals with Citizens United. But I had sat in his committee for a while and they asked him, why now? You know, and he said, because I felt the urgency because my home state called for a convention on this. So we saw Congress react after just one little state of Vermont.
You have five states that are Democratic controlled.
Yep.
Probably five of the 10 most liberal states in the country. Any luck in a conservative state, in a red state?
Yeah, look, like I said in the beginning, it's a battle. But yes, we have passed New Hampshire under Republican control in both chambers. Just not in the same year. We got to figure that out. You know, like I said, we passed the Missouri Senate twice with the majority of Republicans. But getting it all the way through any state in this climate is tough.
Have you talked to the folks at like ALEC, you know, or the Republican group that helps mm-hmm. model legislation to the states? And
no,
has
we
a
haven't.
Pretty firm grip on a lot of legislation.
We've never talked to them. No.
Maybe you could slide something into the right side.
Part of what we're being accused of already is working with them. You know, oh, we're helping ALEC get their convention. And by the way, you know, on that note, it's important to, because look, there's so much information around this, the convention movement, that it takes a little while, you know, but with regards to that, people get the balanced budget movement for a convention confused with what ALEC's pushing for. And the balanced budget convention push has been, you know, going for 50 years. It's pretty grassroots from what I've seen. I think it's just a couple of people working on that. I don't think they have big money at all behind that movement. The one that actually, I think, does have big money behind it, or more money, is the Convention of the States movement, which you may have heard of. And they're pushing for a convention for three different topics, which is fiscal responsibility, term limits, and reining in the powers of the federal government.
Yeah.
Which is very vague, right?
Well, and all Republican sort of stuff.
Yes. Yeah. That one is a different movement though, right? So they have, I think, 13 states right now. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a huge battle for them to get to 34 too, but they would have to do it on those three topics. So if the state, you know, but that one, I believe there is some money. ALEC, I think, is supporting that movement. Again, I don't spend a whole lot of time worrying about what the other side is doing or researching it.
What's the question I should have asked you that I've failed to so far?
Well, I guess maybe what can people do, you know, to get involved? That's always a good
one.
You
mentioned a little bit, but what can people do to get involved? What if they want to be a volunteer? What if they want to be a donor? What if, you know?
Yeah. So if you're out there and you're listening, and you want to be a part of this movement or you want to learn more, you can go to our website. It's wolf-pac.com. And there's plenty of information on there. There's a tab called Resources, which has all the reports that I mentioned. all of the peer-reviewed reports if you really want to dive into it. It's fascinating reading, actually. But you can go and volunteer. You can become a member. You know, if you want to support us for $10-$25 a month, that is going to make the difference. When you volunteer with the Wolfpack, we really take time to make sure that you learn how to become an active citizen. That, to me, has been one of the most amazing and inspiring things that I've seen, is people who have come to Wolfpack and gone through our training and learned how to go into their state houses and become part of the local process, have gone on to run and become state reps. They're engaged with other issues now. They go to the state houses and regularly testify on other important pieces of legislation. So we teach people how to be active citizens, you know, more than even pushing for our legislation. And that's something that we stress strongly at Wolfpack, is building relationships within the state houses, because that's where our power comes from, actually. Is if we can have a volunteer citizen activist in every single district of this country getting to know their state rep and their state senator, that is huge power. You know, we hit a button and say, hey, and look, by the way, after we pass our legislation, we want to work on other stuff. It's not, you know, so for us, Common Cause and all these other groups, like, let's pass our legislation. Let's move on with our lives. Let's start passing all kinds of other good legislation. Like, we just helped our volunteers on the ground who were active in lobbying to help our legislation pass there, just worked with Represent Us in New Jersey to pass a really good government bill. You will absolutely learn from us how to be an active citizen if you volunteer. So I'd really encourage people to think about doing that.
What have you learned about building a group in the political space from this?
Oh, man, so much. Well, we've learned above anything else, if I had to say one thing about organizing, it's that, and this was just reinforced from a book I read, Rules for Revolutionaries, it's that people are, especially millennials and people who are tech savvy, are always trying to design some kind of technology that, you know, can just organize people quickly and motivate people and get them to take action. But none of it can replace, like, the personal relationships. That book could have been retitled Pick Up the Damn Phone. To build a real movement, a revolution, you have to have people connecting with each other. You have to. You cannot just send out emails or even texts and expect people to take action. You know, we're all insanely busy. We've got 20 emails to respond to at any given hour. Facebook, you know, beeps popping up. I mean, we're an incredibly distractible, busy generation. Mm-hmm. So the only thing that's going to get past that is people connecting with each other, getting out and meeting in person, and feeling like they're part of the movement. You know, we encourage meetups, people to get together in person. We have citizen action days where we have people go to the Capitol on a certain day and all go to their legislators, you know, office and get to know them. That's how you do it, you know. And if you don't have time, I mean, it really does, it's fairly simple at the end of the day. Either donate some of your time if you get it. I mean, that's the thing, right? If you don't think this is an important issue, there's nothing we can do. But if you do think that fixing the amount, you know, of money and the corruption right now in our government, then either contribute a little bit of your time or $10 a month, and we can get this done. You know, again, the numbers are on our side. 300 million people in this country. We've never had the internet before, right? It comes down to that. So I'm a huge supporter of net neutrality. Like, if they take that from us, which they've already, you know, we're working on that. They're working on that pretty hard. But right now we still have it. We can still organize. And let's seize this moment. Like, this is a moment in time where if we can organize to get our government back before they take all these things from us, and God, they are working extremely hard, we can do it. It's a hero's journey in some sense, right? You were asking people to come out of your daily lives, your work, and, you know, whatever routine that you're normally
come off the telephone pole and get to work.
Come off the telephone pole and come into this insane journey, you know, of trying to fix our government and be a part of the movement. And this is our issue to fix. This is our generation's issue to fix. So we're going to do it. Whether it's in 5 years or 10 years or 20 years is up to the amount of people who get involved, honestly. So,
well, Mike, it's been an honor to talk to you today. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I really appreciate the time. And great podcast here. Yeah, keep up the good work with that.
Thank you. That was Mike Mineta at Wolfpack. He's at wolf-pack.com. I wonder how long it takes to fix our election financing system. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.